We're back with a conversation I had in August with William Bryant Logan. He was here to discuss his latest book called Air, The Restless Shaper of the World. I began the second part of our conversation by noting that obviously he had done a lot of research, and I asked him, can you just Google the word air and come up with a whole bunch of stuff?
Oy, oy, oy. Well, if you Google in air, I think I did Google in air, and I think I got, I don't know, 300,000 or 400,000 hits, so I had to do other things. Usually I would be led by someone or something I knew, like meeting this my colleagues, John Haynes, was very meaningful to me because it meant I had somebody who could guide me through that. And I found people all over. I found a very interesting man who studied the way bark beetles communicate with each other, which led me into a whole lot of pheromone thoughts.
And then there's this disease called sacred fire, which leads to some very interesting insights. Can you tell us about that?
There was a major disease in the Middle Ages.
It was a plague, wasn't it?
It was. And, you know, it was called St. Anthony's Fire because a whole religious order was founded to cure people who had it. And they had hundreds and hundreds of hospitals throughout Northern Europe during the Middle Ages. And nobody knew what it was caused by until finally a doctor intuited it. He didn't know what to call it at the time. But it comes from the fact that there's a fungus that grows in rye, not in wheat, but in rye. And you'll see it as a little black kind of hair amongst all of the golden bits of the rye. And everybody thought, well, that's just a part of the rye plant. Well, it's not. It's the ergot, which is a fairly serious problem for people who eat it. And the guy who intuited where it came from figured it out because rich people didn't get it, and rich people didn't eat rye. They ate wheat. They could afford wheat. So it was the people living in Northern Europe whose wheat crop was not as dependable as Southern Europe's who were forced to eat this stuff. And then found themselves getting sick.
But I like rye bread. We no longer have the problem.
Well, we actually keep it out, except in places where they put it in, because it turns out to be very useful for a couple of things. It's very useful for easing the pains of childbirth. So it's been used for that. And in fact, people grow ergot for that reason.
Well, how is it related to the development of LSD?
The same chemicals. One of the symptoms was you could go quite stark raving mad and see things that weren't there. And the same chemical. The chemical that they derived LSD from was derived from the ergot of the wheat because it's partly what's in there.
Did pollination begin with the movement of the winds? I mean, now we rely on insects to pollinate our plants largely, don't we?
Yes. Well, not largely, but there's still more insect-pollinated plants than there were. But to start with, most things were pollinated by wind pollination, and still most of the trees and grasses are. So they, you know, like the fungi, put out lots and lots of pollen grains in order to get one hit.
Well, they have to rely on the wind because if a tree just drops its fruit at its roots, another tree isn't going to grow there. It already has too much competition. So it has to be taken off by other ways. Wind sometimes, other animals. But we have a thing actually called pollen rain, don't we?
Yeah, and it's fun. If you take spore samples in the spring, you will find a lot of the pollen rain in it. I took some in the spring in the Sierra Nevada in California, just full of birch pollen, which is a beautiful, beautiful roundish thing with little kind of crenulations in the middle of it that are just quite gorgeous. And I found millions of them, but I wouldn't find them 3 weeks later because they all come in one shot.
What does pollen tell us about history?
Well, palynologists are very important among people studying things like the coming and going of the Ice Age and also the beginnings of human cultivation, because you can, by looking at the layers of pollen that were laid down on the ground at a certain stratum of history, you can tell what was there. If you see grass pollens and you see not so many tree pollens, you know that that area was probably cleared and probably cleared for farming. And you'll also find weed pollen and things that you wouldn't find elsewhere. And people who are trying to assess what happened after the last ice age will look first for the pollens, the kind of tundra flora that were there to begin with. Then they'll start to see things like birch and pine, and they'll think, okay, well, this is where the forest is beginning. And then they'll see, finally, alder and oak and ash and the mature forest plants, and they can then time when all those things happen.
And I'm assuming that looks different in different parts of the world. What do the pollen records of the eastern United States tell us about our area?
Well, that's mostly what happened. It still happens to this day in our area. If you look in an area that's been burned over and things are coming back into it, what's coming first back is birch and pine and also a couple of the prunus, a couple of cherries. Those come, they die very quickly. People, when they're arborists, people frequently say, why aren't my birch trees living longer? It's their job to live a short time and give way to things that live a longer time.
A listener, Tim from Morristown, wonders if you could comment on how air has conveyed pollution from things like the fallout in Japan. Are we experiencing some of the radiation that happened after the Fukushima disaster?
We may very well be. There's no reason not to. It depends in part on how high the matter gets into the air. If it gets up high enough into the stratosphere, for example, it'll circle the globe.
Well, Chernobyl had a major impact on Scandinavia, didn't it? Because of wind currents?
And I think that, you know, we haven't seen what the effect is on the western United States. I think more likely Fukushima would have more effect on the western United States. But there, you know, look at 9/11. I mean, we had very serious effects here on account of what was put out of 9/11, which was mostly not as toxic as something irradiated material is, but was toxic enough that it could lodge in your lungs and cause disease.
Above ground nuclear tests had an effect all across the United States. We saw it increased radioactivity in milk.
Yeah,
because cows were eating grass where the radiation had fallen. I guess that was just brought over by wind currents.
Yes, and wind currents have also brought pollutants and radiation into they found radiation in the breast milk of Inuit women in the Arctic. How has that got there? It got there through the air.
Spiders also travel by means of the air. Is their method any different from that of pollen or spores?
Well, to some extent it is, because it's extremely active. They'll climb up to the top of a stem and they'll do what's called tiptoeing, and then they will release from their spinnerets all kinds of very long filaments, the same kind of filaments that they would use for making a web, only these are making kind of just a wing array. And then when the wind is high enough, it will pull them off of their perches and take them sometimes only a few feet and sometimes 100 miles.
100 miles?
Yeah, there are some it's hard to say exactly how far because nobody has succeeded in actually tracking one. But they've seen them take off and sometimes land again, and others they've seen take off, go way up into the air, and not come down again. But they've caught them. Sailors report catching them out at sea.
But they're not gliding the way some birds would.
They're kind of ballooning because they don't really have lift. They don't have lift mechanisms, but they're light enough. And with these filaments out behind them, they kind of balloon. They're light enough to balloon on air currents.
You write about a man named Pierre Miquel. What did he want to discover about Paris?
He was the first man to look at, first guy really to have a spore sucker. And he was interested in finding out. He thought he was at Pasteur's time, and he thought, well, maybe the fungi and the bacteria are causing most of our diseases, and maybe they're brought in from a great distance. So he started taking samples all over Paris, both inside the town and outside in the suburbs. He would take them down in the sewers. He would take them inside hospitals. And he found that there were indeed a great number more bacteria coming from Paris than there were fungi, whereas there were more fungi than bacteria in the country. But he was kind of disappointed because he didn't really find a lot of terrible diseases on account of this. But on the other hand, he was the first guy to really show us what was going on, and he was the first man to theorize that bacteria actually reproduce in the air, which was poo-pooed and belittled for many years, and we're now beginning to see is probably the case.
Well, he did this for decades, didn't he?
He did.
So
yeah.
He didn't come up with his conclusions right away.
No, he collected and he collected and he collected.
Now, you mentioned 9/11. 2 days after the plane struck the Twin Towers on 9/11, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani declared the air was safe to breathe again. You were working down there in Lower Manhattan at the time?
We were actually working in Lower Manhattan at the time the plane struck, and I wasn't. My crew was, and I got a call from my foreman saying something's happening here because they were up in some trees, and they said, I just picked up on my pole saw a piece of something that looks like paper, but it appears to have blood on it. So they walked out of Manhattan, and several weeks later, we had to return to another site near the Trade Center. It took us a long time to get there because we went through checkpoint after checkpoint after checkpoint. And we had been told, and we're under the impression that just being there for the hour or two it was going to take us to do our work would be okay. We wouldn't need masks or anything. But because we apply pesticides, I had a lot of mask material with me. When we got there, we got out of the truck, took one look, took a few breaths of air, and said, okay, bring out the masks.
So the mayor was reassuring us incorrectly.
I think, yeah. And I think the head of the EPA, who was asked about it later, said, well, what did you expect me to do? I needed to reassure people. And I said, well, quite frankly, as someone there, I would rather have known the truth than be reassured about something that could have damaged me.
The air also had a terrible smell. Because our studios in those days were not all that far away from the World Trade Center site. And even months afterward, when we were finally allowed back in our studios, when the doors to the A-train opened, you immediately were hit by some very strange smell, which some people thought was the smell of burning flesh. Probably wasn't, but it was all the pollutants in the air, I imagine.
Well, and all of the stuff. I mean, you know, those buildings were made almost entirely out of glass and plastic. And all of those, when they were vaporized, and also a lot of them burned, and they created these things called carbon nanotubes, which are extremely tiny, tiny in length, or rather in diameter, but long in length. And a lot of those have been implicated in some fairly serious lung diseases because they're small enough in diameter to get into the lungs and lodge, but then they're too large to move out again. So they've created all kinds of fibrosis problems in people's lungs.
You write about the weaving of gases and ground. What happens in the air above Brazil's Amazon rainforest?
Yeah, this is one of the things that most fascinated me in researching this book was the fact that I thought rain was rain. But it turns out that in most of the world, most of the time, raindrops are a solution between aerosols, invisible liquids and solids in the air, and the water. And that's what allows rain to fall. In the Amazon...
Otherwise, it would fall in sheets.
Or otherwise it wouldn't fall at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if you get very warm conditions, you can get rain to fall just as it is. Sometimes you get very cold conditions, you can get ice crystals to form and those will fall and start rain. But we often have water in the air, but you need to get enough mass in each drop of water that a few of them can start falling. And then they can coalesce with others and then make a rain or a snowstorm.
So when we have years where there are more rain storms than others and we have more hurricanes, can we predict how human behavior has played a role in that?
Unfortunately, we can't exactly. In fact, originally, though, students of pollution thought that it was going to produce droughts because when there's so many aerosols in the air, each one attracts water, and it's a whole lot of cloud droplets, a whole lot of little droplets, but none of them are coalesced. They're all tiny. So the theory was that they would never fall. They would just stay up there. We'd have a lot of clouds, and we'd have no rain. Well, that turns out not to be the case, but... Still, yeah, it's an interesting question as to what we have done. And certainly one thing we have done is caused there to be, on aggregate, a great deal, at least 5% more water vapor continually in the air now than was, say, in the 1960s, and that's a lot more fuel.
Well, a few years ago, I spoke to a scientist in Brazil who said that Brazil had had its first hurricane that didn't go north but came into Brazil and into the Amazon. And I'm assuming that's because of human activity.
I'm not sure whether that's the case or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it never happened before. The people are changing the Amazon simply by things like open burning.
Yeah, no question about it. And they're also changing. If you go deep into the Amazon, you'll still find conditions that are probably fairly much as they were 100 years ago. But the closer you get to the edges, the more they're part of our world, where there are always tremendous numbers of aerosols in the air.
When we look at paintings from the past, the paintings of sky, do we see changes in the way the air has been circulating? Or does it pretty much look the same?
That people didn't. I don't think it's so much what the air is doing differently. I think it's what people are representing differently. And I happen to love this. My longing is to give a cloud walk through the Metropolitan Museum, because you can go from the Middle Ages when they didn't even bother to represent the sky. They would do it in gold leaf, right? And one of the reasons was that a lot of the early Christian thinkers, like Augustine, regarded the air as the domain of demons. That's where the demons lived. So you didn't want to have it there. But then as you go forward, you start to find more and more air creeping into paintings until finally you get somebody like El Greco, and my goodness, the foundations of heaven are air, and people are turning into convective storms. It's really cool.
And we see different portrayals of air from Peter Bruegel the Elder, Peter Paul Rubens, all of them telling us what the world thought of air at the time.
Yeah, especially the Rubens is wonderful because they always tell you that the Roman gods are personifications of natural forces. And in the painting, it's based on Baucis and Philemon, the story from the Metamorphosis about the two old people who, unbeknownst to them, entertain the gods. And the gods decide to destroy the world.
His book, his latest, is Air, The Restless Shaper of the World. It is published by Norton. I'm assuming this is the end of the series.
I think it may be.
Thank you so much for being on our show today.
My pleasure.